Hackworth arrives at work. A visit to the design works. Mr. Cotton's vocation. Rain beaded on the specular toes of Hackworth's boots as he strode under the vaulting wrought-iron gate. The little beads reflected the silver-gray light of the sky as they rolled off onto the pedimotive's treadplates and dripped to the gray-brown cobblestones with each stride. Hackworth excused himself through a milling group of uncertain Hindus. Their hard shoes were treacherous on the cobblestones, their chins were in the air so that their high white collars would not saw their heads off. They had arisen many hours ago in their tiny high-rise warrens, their human coin lockers on the island south of New Chusan, which was Hindustani. They had crossed into Shanghai in the wee hours on autoskates and velocipedes, probably paid off some policemen, made their way to the causeway joining New Chusan to the city. Machine Phase Systems Limited knew that they were coming, because they came every day. The company could have set up an employment causeway, or even in Shanghai itself, but the company liked to have job seekers come all the way to the main campus to fill out their applications. The difficulty of getting here prevented people from coming on a velleity, and the eternal presence of these people, like starlings peering down hungrily at a picnic, reminded everyone who was lucky enough to have a job that others were waiting to take their place. The design works emulated a university campus in more ways than its architects had really intended. If a campus was a green quadrilateral described by hulking, heterated Gothics, then this was a campus. But if a campus was also a factory of sorts, most of whose population sat in rows and columns in large stuffy rooms and did essentially the same things all day, then the design works was a campus for that reason too. Hackworth detoured through Merkle Hall. It was Gothic and very large, like most of the design works. Its vaulted ceiling was decorated with a hard fresco consisting of paint on plaster. Since this entire building, except for the fresco, had been grown straight from the feed, it would have been easier to build a mediatron into the ceiling and set it to display a soft fresco, which could have been changed from time to time. But new Victorians almost never used mediatrons. Hard art demanded commitment from the artist. It could only be done once, and if you screwed it up, you had to live with the consequences. The centerpiece of the fresco was a flock of cybernetic cherubs, each shouldering a spherical atom, converging on some central work in progress, a construct of some several hundred atoms, radially symmetric, perhaps intended to look like a bearing or motor. Brooding over the whole thing, quite large but obviously not to scale, was a white-coated engineer with a monocular nanophenomenoscope strapped to his head. No one really used them because you couldn't get depth perception, but it looked better on the fresco because you could see the engineer's other eye, steel blue, dilated, scanning infinity like the steel oculus of Arecibo. With one hand, the engineer stroked his waxed mustache. The other was thrust into a nanomanipulator, and it was made obvious through glorious overuse of radiant trompe-l'oeil that the atom-humping cherubs were all dancing to his tune, naiads to the engineer's Neptune. The corners of the fresco were occupied with miscellaneous busywork. In the upper left, Fainan and Drexler and Merkel, Chen and Singh and Finkel McGraw, reposed on a numinous buckyball, some of them reading books and some pointing toward the work in progress in a manner that implied constructive criticism. In the upper right was Queen Victoria II, who managed to look serene despite the gaudiness of her perch, a throne of solid diamond. The bottom fringe of the work was crowded with small figures, mostly children with the occasional long-suffering mom, ordered chronologically. On the left were the spirits of generations past, who had showed up too early to enjoy the benefits of nanotechnology and, not explicitly shown but somewhat ghoulishly implied, croaked from obsolete causes such as cancer, scurvy, boiler explosions, derailments, drive-by shootings, pogroms, blitzkriegs, mineshaft collapses, ethnic cleansing, meltdowns, running with scissors, eating Drano, heating a cold house with charcoal briquettes, and being gored by oxen. Surprisingly, none of them seemed sullen. They were all watching the activities of the engineer and his cherubic workforce, their cuddly uplifted faces illuminated by the light streaming from the center, liberated, as Hackworth the engineer literal-mindedly supposed, by the binding energy of the atoms as they plummeted into their assigned potential wells. The children in the center had their backs to Hackworth and were mostly seen in silhouette, looking directly up and raising their arms toward the light. The kids in bottom right balanced the angelic host on the bottom left. These were the spirits of unborn children yet to benefit from the engineer's work, though they certainly looked eager to get born as soon as possible. Their backdrop was a luminescent, undulous curtain, much like the aurora, which was actually a continuation of the flowing skirts of Victoria II, seated on her throne above.
"Pardon me, Mr. Cotton,"
Hackworth said, almost sotto voce. He had worked here once for several years and knew the etiquette. 100 designers were sitting in the hall, neatly arranged in rows. All had their heads wrapped up in phenomenoscopes. The only persons who were aware of Hackworth's presence in the hall were supervising engineer Durig, his lieutenants Chu, DeGrado, and Byerly, and a few water boys and couriers standing erect at their stations around the perimeter. It was bad form to startle the engineers, so you approached them loudly and spoke to them softly.
"Good morning, Mr. Hackworth," Cotton said.
"Good morning, Demetrius. Take your time.
I'll be with you in a moment, sir."
Cotton was a southpaw. His left hand was in a black glove. Laced through it was a network of invisibly tiny rigid structures, motors, position sensors, and tactile stimulators. The sensors kept track of his hand's position, how much each joint of each knuckle was bent, and so on. The rest of the gear made him feel as though he were touching real objects. The glove's movements were limited to a roughly hemispherical domain with a radius of about 1 cubit. As long as his elbow stayed on or near its comfy elastomeric rest, his hand was free. The glove was attached to a web of infinitesimal wires that emerged from filatories placed here and there around the workstation. The filatories acted like motorized reels, taking up slack and occasionally pulling the glove one way or another to simulate external forces. In fact, they were not motors, but little wire factories that generated wire when it was needed, and, when slack needed to be taken up or a wire needed a tug, sucked it back in and digested it. Each wire was surrounded by a loose accordion sleeve a couple of millimeters in diameter, which was there for safety, lest visitors stick their hands in and slice off fingers on the invisible wires. Cotton was working with some kind of elaborate structure consisting, probably, of several 100,000 atoms. Hackworth could see this because each workstation had a mediatron, providing a two-dimensional view of what the user was seeing. This made it easy for the supervisors to roam up and down the aisles and see at a glance what each employee was up to. The structures these people worked with seemed painfully bulky to Hackworth, even though he'd done it himself for a few years. The people here in Merkle Hall were all working on mass-market consumer products, which, by and large, were not very demanding. They worked in symbiosis with big software that handled repetitive aspects of the job. It was a fast way to design products, which was essential when going after the fickle and impressionable consumer market. But systems designed that way always ended up being enormous. An automated design system could always make something work by throwing more atoms at it. Every engineer in this hall, designing those nanotechnological toasters and hairdryers, wished he could have Hackworth's job in bespoke, where consinity was an end in itself, where no atom was wasted and every subsystem was designed specifically for the task at hand. Such work demanded intuition and creativity, qualities neither abundant nor encouraged here in Merkle Hall. But from time to time, over golf or karaoke or cigars, Durig or one of the other supervisors would mention some youngster who showed promise. Because Lord Alexander Chung-Sik Finkel McGraw was paying for Hackworth's current project, the young lady's illustrated primer, price was no object. The Duke would brook no malingering or corner-cutting, so everything was as start as bespoke could make it. Every atom could be justified. Even so, there was nothing especially interesting about the power supply being created for the primer, which consisted of batteries of the same kind used to run everything from toys to airships. So Hackworth had farmed that part of the job out to Cotton, just to see whether he had potential. Cotton's gloved hand fluttered and probed like a stuck horsefly in the center of the black web. On the mediatronic screen attached to his workstation, Hackworth saw that Cotton was gripping a medium-sized, by Merkle Hall standards, sub-assembly, presumably belonging to some much larger nanotechnological system. The standard color scheme used in these phenomenoscopes depicted carbon atoms in green, sulfur in yellow, oxygen in red, and hydrogen in blue. Cotton's assembly, as seen from a distance, was generally turquoise, because it consisted mostly of carbon and hydrogen, and because Hackworth's point of view was so far away that the thousands of individual atoms all blended together. It was a gridwork of long, straight, but rather bumpy rods laid across each other at right angles. Hackworth recognized it as a rod logic system, a mechanical computer. Cotton was trying to snap it together with some larger part. From this, Hackworth inferred that the auto-assembly process, which Cotton would have tried first, hadn't worked quite right, and so now Cotton was trying to maneuver the part into place by hand. This wouldn't fix what was wrong with it, but the telesthetic feedback coming into his hand through those wires would give him insight as to which bumps were lining up with which holes and which weren't. It was an intuitive approach to the job, a practice furiously prescribed by the lecturers at the Royal Nanotechnological Institute, but popular among Hackworth's naughty, clever colleagues.
"Okay," Cotton finally said. "I see the problem."
His hand relaxed. On the Mediatron, the subassembly drifted away from the main group under its own momentum, then slowed, stopped, and began to fall back toward it, drawn in by weak van der Waals forces. Cotton's right hand was resting on a small cord board. He whacked a key that froze the simulation, then, as Hackworth noted approvingly, groped the keys for a few seconds, typing in some documentation. Meanwhile, he was withdrawing his left hand from the glove and using it to pull the rig off his head. Its straps and pads left neat indentations in the nap of his hair.
"Is this the smart makeup?" Hackworth said, nodding at the screen.
"The next step beyond," Cotton said. "Remote control."
"Controlled how, Yuvri?"
Hackworth said, meaning Universal Voice Recognition Interface.
"A specialized variant thereof, yes, sir,"
Cotton said. Then, lowering his voice,
"Word has it they considered makeup with nanoreceptors for galvanic skin response, pulse, respiration, and so on, so that it would respond to the wearer's emotional state. This superficial, need I say it, cosmetic issue concealed an undertow that pulled them out into deep and turbulent philosophical waters."
"What? Philosophy of makeup?"
"Think about it, Mr. Hackworth. Is the function of makeup to respond to one's emotions, or precisely not to do so?"
"These waters are already over my head," Hackworth admitted.
"You'll be wanting to know about the power supply for Runcible," Cotton said, using the code name for the illustrated primer.
Cotton had no idea what Runcible was, just that it needed a relatively long-lived power supply.
"Yes. The modifications you requested are complete. I ran the tests you specified, plus a few others that occurred to me. All of them are documented here."
Cotton grabbed the heavy brass-like pull of his desk drawer and paused for a fraction of a second while the embedded fingerprint recognition logic did its work. The drawer unlocked itself, and Cotton pulled it open to reveal a timeless assortment of office drawer miscellany, including several sheets of paper, some blank, some printed, some scrawled on, and one sheet that was blank except for the word Runcible, printed at the top in Cotton's neat draftsman's hand. Cotton pulled this one out and spoke to it.
"Demetrius James Cotton, transferring all privileges to Mr. Hackworth."
"John Percival Hackworth in receipt," Hackworth said, taking the page from Cotton.
"Thank you, Mr. Cotton."
"You're welcome, sir."
"Cover sheet," Hackworth said to the piece of paper, and then it had pictures and writing on it, and the pictures moved. A schematic of a machine phase system cycling.
"If I'm not being too forward by inquiring," Cotton said, "will you be compiling Runcible soon?"
"Today, most likely," Hackworth said.
"Please feel free to inform me of any glitches," Cotton said, just for the sake of form.
"Thank you, Demetrius," Hackworth said. "Letter, fold," he said to the piece of paper, and it creased itself neatly into thirds.
Hackworth put it in the breast pocket of his jacket and walked out of Merkle Hall. Particulars of Nell and Harv's domestic situation. Harv brings back a wonder. Whenever Nell's clothes got too small for her, Harv would pitch them in the deke bin and then have the MC make new ones. Sometimes, if Tequila was going to take Nell someplace where they would see other moms with other daughters, she'd use the MC to make Nell a special dress with lace and ribbons, so that the other moms would see how special Nell was and how much Tequila loved her. The kids would sit in front of the Mediatron and watch a passive, and the moms would sit nearby and talk sometimes or watch the Mediatron sometimes. Nell listened to them, especially when Tequila was talking, but she didn't really understand all the words. She knew, because Tequila repeated it often, that when Tequila got pregnant with Nell, she had been using something called the Freedom Machine, a mite that lived in your womb and caught eggs and ate them. Victorians didn't believe in them, but you could buy them from Chinese and Hindustanis who, of course, had no scruples. You never knew when they'd all gotten too worn out to work anymore, which is how Tequila had ended up with Nell. One of the women said you could buy a special kind of Freedom Machine that would go in there and eat a fetus. Nell didn't know what a fetus was, but all of the women apparently did, and thought that the idea was the kind of thing that only the Chinese or Hindustanis would ever think up. Tequila said she knew all about that sort of freedom machine, but didn't want to use one, because she was afraid it might be gross. Sometimes Tequila would bring back pieces of real cloth from her work, because she said that the rich Victorians she worked for would never miss them. She never let Nell play with them, and so Nell did not understand the difference between real cloth and the kind that came from the MC. Harve found a piece of it once. The leased territories where they lived had their own beach, and Harve and his friends liked to go prospecting there, early in the morning, for things that had drifted across from Shanghai, or that the Vickies in New Atlantis Clave had flushed down their water closets. What they were really looking for was pieces of stretchy, slippery nanobar. Sometimes the nanobar was in the shape of condoms. Sometimes it came in larger chunks that were used to wrap things up and preserve them from the depredations of mites. In any case, it could be gathered up and sold to certain persons who knew how to clean it and weld one piece of nanobar to another and make it into protective suits and other shapes. Harve had quietly stuffed the piece of cloth into his shoe and then limped home, not saying a word to anyone. That night, Nell, lying on her red mattress, was troubled by vague dreams about strange lights and finally woke up to see a blue monster in her room. It was Harve, underneath his blanket with a torch, doing something. She climbed out very slowly so as not to disturb Dinosaur, Duck, Peter, and Purple, and stuck her head beneath the blanket, and found Harve, holding a little flashlight in his teeth, working at something with a pair of toothpicks.
"Harve," she said, "are you working on a mite?"
"No, dummy."
Harve's voice was hushed, and he had to mumble around the little button-shaped torch he was holding in his teeth.
"Mites are a lot smaller. See? Look."
She crawled forward a little more, drawn as much by warmth and security as by curiosity, and saw a limp, mottled brown thing a few centimeters on a side, fuzzy around the edges, resting on Harve's crossed ankles.
"What is it?"
"It's magic. Watch this,"
Harve said, and worrying at it with his toothpick, he teased something loose.
"It's got string coming out of it,"
Nell said.
"Shh."
Harve gripped the end of the thread beneath his thumbnail and pulled. It looked quite short, but it lengthened as he pulled, and the fuzzy edge of the piece of fabric waffled too fast to see, and then the thread had come loose entirely. He held it up for inspection, then let it drift down onto a heap of others just like it.
"How many does it have?"
Nell said.
"Nell,"
Harve said, turning to face her so that his light shone into her face, his voice coming out of the light epiphanically.
"You got it wrong. It's not that the thing has threads in it. It is threads. Threads going under and over each other. If you pulled out all the threads, nothing would be left."
"Did mites make it?"
Nell asked.
"The way it's made. So digital. Each thread going over and under other threads, and those ones going over and under all the other threads."
Harve stopped for a moment, his mind overloaded by the inhuman audacity of the thing, the promiscuous reference frames.
"It had to be mites, Nell. Nothing else could do it."
Security measures adopted by Atlantis Shanghai. Atlantis Shanghai occupied the loftiest 90% of New Chuzan's land area, an inner plateau about a mile above sea level where the air was cooler and cleaner. Parts of it were marked off with a lovely wrought iron fence, but the real border was defended by something called the Dog Pod Grid, a swarm of quasi-independent aerostats. Aerostat meant anything that hung in the air. This was an easy trick to pull off nowadays. Nanotech materials were stronger, computers were infinitesimal, power supplies were much more potent. It was almost difficult not to build things that were lighter than air. Really simple things like packaging materials, the constituents of litter basically, tended to float around as if they weighed nothing, and aircraft pilots cruising along 10 kilometers above sea level had become accustomed to the sight of empty, discarded grocery bags zooming past their windshields and getting sucked into their engines. As seen from low Earth orbit, the upper atmosphere now looked dandruffy. Protocol insisted that everything be made heavier than need be, so that it would fall, and capable of being degraded by ultraviolet light. But some people violated protocol. Given that it was so easy to make things that would float in air, it was not much of a stretch to add an air turbine. This was nothing more than a small propeller, or a series of them, mounted in a tubular foramen, rot through the body of the aerostat, drawing in air at one end and forcing it out the other to generate thrust. A device built with several thrusters pointed along different axes could remain in one position or indeed navigate through space. Each aerostat in the dog pod grid was a mirror-surfaced aerodynamic teardrop, just wide enough at its widest part to have contained a ping-pong ball. These pods were programmed to hang in space in a hexagonal grid pattern, about 10 centimeters apart near the ground, close enough to stop a dog, but not a cat, hence dog pods, and spaced wider as they got higher. In this fashion, a hemispherical dome was limned around the sacrosanct airspace of the new Atlantis clave. When wind gusted, the pods all swung into it like weather vanes, and the grid deformed for a bit as the pods were shoved around. But all of them eventually worked their way back into place, swimming upstream like minnows, propelling the air turbines. The binds made a thin hissing noise, like a razor blade cutting air, that, when multiplied by the number of pods within earshot, engendered a not altogether cheerful ambience. Enough wrestling with the wind, and a pod's battery would run down. Then it would swim over and nuzzle its neighbor. The two would mate in midair, like dragonflies, and the weaker would take power from the stronger. The system included larger aerostats called nurse drones that would cruise around dumping large amounts of power into randomly selected pods all over the grid, which would then distribute it to their neighbors. If a pod thought it was having mechanical trouble, it would send out a message, and a fresh pod would fly out from the Royal Security installation beneath Source Victoria and relieve it so that it could fly home to be decompiled. As numerous 8-year-old boys had discovered, you could not climb the dog pod grid because the pods didn't have enough thrust to support your weight. Your foot would just mash the first pod into the ground. It would try to work its way loose, but if it were stuck in mud or its turbines fouled, another pod would have to come out and replace it. For the same reason, you could pluck any pod from its place and carry it away. When Hackworth had performed this stunt as a youth, he had discovered that the farther it got from its appointed place, the hotter it became, all the while politely informing him in clipped military diction that he had best release it or fall victim to vaguely adumbrated consequences. But nowadays, you could just steal one or two whenever you felt like it, and a new one would come out and replace it. Once they figured out they were no longer part of the grid, the pods would self-scramble and become instant souvenirs. This user-friendly approach did not imply that grid tampering went ignored, or that such activities were approved of. You could walk through the grid whenever you chose by shoving a few pods out of the way, unless Royal Security had told the pods to electrocute you or blast you into chum. If so, they would politely warn you before doing it. Even when they were in a more passive mode, though, the aerostats were watching and listening, so that nothing got through the dog pod grid without becoming an instant media celebrity, with hundreds of uniformed fans down in Royal Joint Forces Command. Unless it was microscopic. Microscopic invaders were more of the threat nowadays. Just to name one example, there was Red Death, a.k.a. the 7-Minute Special, a tiny aerodynamic capsule that burst open after impact and released 1,000 or so corpuscle-sized bodies, known colloquially as cookie cutters, into the victim's bloodstream. It took about 7 minutes for all of the blood in a typical person's body to recirculate. So after this interval, the cookie cutters would be randomly distributed throughout the victim's organs and limbs. A cookie cutter was shaped like an aspirin tablet, except that the top and bottom were domed more to withstand ambient pressure. For like most other nanotechnological devices, a cookie cutter was filled with vacuum. Inside were 2 centrifuges, rotating on the same axes but in opposite directions, preventing the unit from acting like a gyroscope. The device could be triggered in various ways. The most primitive were simple 7-minute time bombs. Detonation dissolved the bonds holding the centrifuges together so that each of 1,000 or so ballisticules suddenly flew outward. The enclosing shell shattered easily, and each ballisticule kicked up a shockwave, doing surprisingly little damage at first, tracing narrow linear disturbances and occasionally taking a chip out of a bone. But soon they slowed to near the speed of sound, where shockwave piled on top of shockwave to produce a sonic boom. Then all the damage happened at once. Depending on the initial speed of the centrifuge, this could happen at varying distances from the detonation point. Most everything inside the radius was undamaged, but everything near it was pulped. Hence, cookie cutter. The victim then made a loud noise like the crack of a whip as a few fragments exited his or her flesh and dropped through the sound barrier in air. startled witnesses would turn just in time to see the victim flushing bright pink. Blood-red crescents would suddenly appear all over the body. These marked the geometric intersection of detonation surfaces with skin and were a boon to forensic types, who could thereby identify the type of cookie cutter by comparing the marks against a handy pocket reference card. The victim was just a big, leaky sack of undifferentiated gore at this point, and, of course, never survived. Such inventions had spawned concern that people from File A might surreptitiously introduce a few million lethal devices into the bodies of members of File B, providing the technically sweetest possible twist on the trite, ancient dream of being able instantly to turn a whole society into gravy. A few inroads of that kind had been made. A few mass-closed casket funerals had been held, but not many. It was hard to control these devices. If a person ate or drank one, it might end up in their body, but it might just go into the food chain and get recycled into the body of someone you liked. But the big problem was the host's immune system, which caused enough of a histological fuss to tip off the intended victims. What worked in the body could work elsewhere, which is why files had their own immune systems now. The impregnable shield paradigm didn't work at the nano level. One needed to hack the mean-free path. A well-defended clave was surrounded by an aerial buffer zone infested with immunocules, microscopic aerostats designed to seek and destroy invaders. In the case of Atlantis Shanghai, this zone was never shallower than 20 kilometers. The innermost ring was a greenbelt lying on both sides of the dog pod grid, and the outer ring was called the Leased Territories. It was always foggy in the leased territories, because all of the immunocules in the air served as nuclei for the condensation of water vapor. If you stared carefully into the fog and focused on a point inches in front of your nose, you could see it sparkling, like so many microscopic searchlights, as the immunocules swept space with LIDAR beams. LIDAR was like radar, except that it used the smaller wavelengths that happened to be visible to the human eye. The sparkling of tiny lights was the evidence of microscopic dreadnoughts hunting each other implacably through the fog, like U-boats and destroyers in the black water of the North Atlantic. Nell sees something peculiar. Hob explains all. One morning, Nell looked out the window and saw the world had turned the color of pencil lead. Cars, velocipedes, quadrupeds, even power skaters left towering black vortices in their wakes. Harv came back from being out all night. Nell screamed when she saw him because he was a charcoal wraith with two monstrous growths on his face. He peeled back a filter mask to reveal grayish-pink skin underneath. He showed her his white teeth and then took up coughing. He went about this methodically, conjuring tangles of spun phlegm from his deepest alveoli and projecting them into the toilet. Now and then he would stop just to breathe, and a faint whistling noise would come from his throat. Harv did not explain himself, but went about working with his things. He unscrewed the bulges on his mask and took out black things that kicked up little black dust storms when he tossed them onto the floor. He replaced them with a couple of white things that he took from a nanobar wrapper, though by the time he was finished, the white things were covered with his black fingerprints, the ridges and whorls perfectly resolved. He held the nanobar wrapper up to the light for a moment.
"Early protocol,"
he rasped, and pitched it toward the wastebasket. Then he held the mask up to Nell's face, guided the straps around her head, and tightened them down. Her long hair got caught in the buckles and pinched, but her objections were muffled by the mask. It took a little effort to breathe now. The mask pressed against her face when she inhaled and whooshed when she exhaled.
"Keep it on," Harv said. "It'll protect you from toner."
"What's toner?"
she mumbled. The words did not make it out through the mask, but Harv guessed them from the look in her eyes.
"Mites," he said, "or so they say down at the flea circus anyway."
He picked up one of the black things taken from the mask and flicked it with a fingertip. A cinericeous cloud swirled out of it, like a drop of ink in a glass of water, and hung swirling in the air, neither rising nor falling. Sparkles of light flashed in the midst of it like fairy dust.
"See, there's mites around. All the time. They use the sparkles to talk to each other," Harv explained. "They're in the air, in food and water, everywhere. And there's rules that these mites are supposed to follow, and those rules are called protocols. And there's a protocol from way back that says they're supposed to be good for your lungs.
They're supposed to break down into safe pieces if you breathe one inside of you.
Harv paused at this point, theatrically, to summon forth one more ebon loogie, which Nell guessed must be swimming with safe mite bits.
But there are people who break those rules sometimes, who don't follow the protocols. I guess if there's too many mites in the air all breaking down inside your lungs, millions, well, maybe those safe pieces aren't so safe if there's millions. But anyways, the guys at the flea circus say that sometimes the mites go to war with each other. Like, maybe someone in Shanghai makes a mite that doesn't follow the protocol and gets his matter compiler to making a whole lot of them and sends them all across the water to New Atlantis Clave to snoop on the Vickies, or even maybe to do them harm. Then some Vicky, one of their protocol enforcement guys, makes a mite to go out and find that mite and kill it, and they get into a war. That's what's happening today, Nell. Mites fighting other mites. This dust, we call it toner, is actually the dead bodies of all those mites.
When will the war be over?
Nell asked, but Harv could not hear her, having entered into another coughing jag. Eventually, Harv got up and tied a strip of white nanobar around his face. The spot over his mouth immediately began turning gray. He ejected used cartridges from his mite gun and inserted new ones. It was shaped like a gun, but it sucked air in instead of shooting things out. You loaded it with drum-shaped cartridges filled with accordion-pleated paper. When you turned it on, it made a little whooshing noise as it sucked air, and hopefully mites, through the paper. The mites got stuck in there.
Gotta go, he said, goosing the trigger on the gun a couple of times. Never know what I might find.
Then he headed for the exit, leaving black toner footprints on the floor, which were scoured away by the swirling air currents in his wake, as if he had never passed that way.
Hackworth compiles the Young Ladies Illustrated Primer, Particulars of the Underlying Technology.
Bespoke was a Victorian house on a hill, a block long and replete with wings, turrets, atria, and breezy verandas. Hackworth was not senior enough to merit a turret or a balcony, but he did have a view into a garden where gardenia and boxwood grew. Sitting at his desk, he could not see the garden, but he could smell it, especially when the wind blew in from the sea. Runcible was sitting on his desk in the form of a stack of papers, most of them signed John Percival Hackworth. He unfolded Cotton's document. It was still running the little industrial cartoon. Cotton had clearly enjoyed himself. No one ever got fired for going with enhanced photorealism, but Hackworth's own signature look was lifted from 19th-century patent applications. Black on white, shades of gray implied with nearly microscopic cross-hatching. Old-fashioned letterpress font, a little rough around the edges. It drove clients wild. They always wanted to blow up the diagrams on their drawing-room mediatrons. Cotton got it. He'd done his diagram in the same style, and so his nanotechnological battery chugged away on the page, looking much like the gear train of an Edwardian dreadnought. Hackworth put Cotton's document atop the Runcible stack and guillotined it against the desktop a couple of times, superstitiously trying to make it look neat. He carried it to the corner of his office over by the window, where a new piece of furniture had recently been rolled in by the porter, a cherrywood cabinet on brass casters. It came up to his waist. On top was a polished brass mechanism, an automatic document reader with detachable tray. A small door in the back betrayed a feed port, 1 centimeter, typical of household appliances, but startlingly wimpy in a heavy industrial works, especially considering that this cabinet contained one of the most powerful computers on Earth, 5 cc's of bespoke rod logic. It used about 100,000 watts of power, which came in over the superconducting part of the feed. The power had to be dissipated, or else the computer would incinerate itself, and most of the building, too. Getting rid of that energy had been much more of an engineering job than the rod logic. The latest feed protocol had a solution built in. A device could now pull ice off the feed, 1 microscopic chunk at a time, and output warm water. Hackworth put the stack of documents into the feed tray on top and told the machine to compile Runcible. There was a card-shuffling buzz as the reader grabbed the edge of each page momentarily and extracted its contents. The flexible feed line, which ran from the wall into the back of the cabinet, jerked and stiffened orgasmically as the computer's work sucked in a tremendous jolt of hypersonic ice and shot back warm water. A fresh sheet of paper appeared in the cabinet's output tray. The top of the document read, Runcible version 1.0, compiled specification. The only other thing on the document was a picture of the final product, nicely rendered in Hackworth's signature pseudo-engraved style. It looked exactly like a book. On his way down the vast helical stair in the largest and most central of Bespoke's atria, Hackworth pondered his upcoming crime. It was entirely too late to go back now. It flustered him that he had unconsciously made up his mind months ago without marking the occasion. Though Bespoke was a design rather than a production house, it had its own matter compilers, including a couple of fairly big ones, 100 cubic meters. Hackworth had reserved a more modest desktop model, 1/10 of a cubic meter. Use of these compilers had to be logged, so he identified himself and the project first. Then the machine accepted the edge of the document. Hackworth told the matter compiler to begin immediately, and then looked through a transparent wall of solid diamond into the eutactic environment. The universe was a disorderly mess, the only interesting bits being the organized anomalies. Hackworth had once taken his family out rowing on the pond in the park, and the ends of the yellow oars spun off compact vortices, and Fiona, who had taught herself the physics of liquids through numerous experimental beverage spills and in the bathtub, demanded an explanation for these holes in water. She leaned over the gunwale, Gwendolyn holding the sash of her dress, and felt those vortices with her hands, wanting to understand them. The rest of the pond, simply water in no particular order, was uninteresting. We ignore the blackness of outer space and pay attention to the stars, especially if they seem to order themselves into constellations. Common as the air meant something worthless, but Hackworth knew that every breath of air that Fiona drew, lying in her little bed at night, just a silver glow in the moonlight, was used by her body to make skin and hair and bones. The air became Fiona, and demanding of love. Ordering matter was the sole endeavor of life, whether it was a jumble of self-replicating molecules in the primordial ocean, or a steam-powered English mill turning weeds into clothing, or Fiona, lying in her bed, turning air into Fiona. A leaf of paper was about 100,000 nanometers thick. A third of a million atoms could fit into this span. Smart paper consisted of a network of infinitesimal computers sandwiched between mediatrons. A mediatron was a thing that could change its color from place to place. Two of them accounted for about 2/3 of the paper's thickness, leaving an internal gap wide enough to contain structures 100,000 atoms wide. Light and air could easily penetrate to this point, so the works were contained within vacuoles. Airless Buckminster fullerene shells, overlaid with a reflective aluminum layer so that they would not implode en masse whenever the page was exposed to sunlight. The interiors of the buckyballs, then, constituted something close to a eutactic environment. Here resided the rod logic that made the paper smart. Each of these spherical computers was linked to its four neighbors, north, east, south, west, by a bundle of flexible push rods running down a flexible, evacuated bucky tube, so that the page as a whole constituted a parallel computer made up of about 1 billion separate processors. The individual processors weren't especially smart or fast, and were so susceptible to the elements that typically only a small fraction of them were working. But even with those limitations, the smart paper still constituted, among other things, a powerful graphical computer. And still, Hackworth reflected, it had nothing on Runcible, whose pages were thicker and more densely packed with computational machinery, each sheet folded 4 times into a 16-page signature, 32 signatures brought together in a spine that, in addition to keeping the book from falling apart, functioned as an enormous switching system and database. It was made to be robust, but it still had to be born in the eutactic womb, a solid diamond vacuum chamber housing a start matter compiler. The diamond was doped with something that let only red light pass through. Standard engineering practice eschewed any molecular bonds that were tenuous enough to be broken by those lazy red photons, underachievers of the visible spectrum. Thus, the growth of your prototype was visible through the window, a good last-ditch safety measure. If your code was buggy and your project grew too large, threatening to shatter the walls of the chamber, you could always shut it down via the ludicrously low-tech expedient of shutting off the feed line. Hackworth wasn't worried, but he watched the initial phases of growth anyway, just because it was always interesting. In the beginning, was an empty chamber, a diamond hemisphere glowing with dim red light. In the center of the floor slab, one could see a naked cross-section of an 8-centimeter feed, a central vacuum pipe surrounded by a collection of smaller lines, each a bundle of microscopic conveyor belts carrying nanomechanical building blocks. Individual atoms, or scores of them, linked together in handy modules. The matter compiler was a machine that sat at the terminus of a feed, and, following a program, plucked molecules from the conveyors one at a time and assembled them into more complicated structures. Hackworth was the programmer. Runcible was the program. It was made up of a number of sub-programs, each of which had resided on a separate piece of paper until a few minutes ago, when the immensely powerful computer in Hackworth's office had compiled them into a single finished program written in a language that the matter compiler could understand. A transparent haze coalesced across the terminus of the feed, mold on an overripe strawberry. The haze thickened and began adopting a shape, some parts a little higher than others. It spread across the floor away from the feed line until it had filled out its footprint. One quadrant of a circle with a radius of 12 centimeters. Hackworth continued to watch until he was sure he could see the top edge of the book growing out of it. In the corner of this lab stood an evolved version of a copy machine that could take just about any kind of recorded information and transmogrify it into something else. It could even destroy a piece of information and then attest to the fact that it had been destroyed, which was useful in the relatively paranoid environment of Bespoke. Hackworth gave it the document containing the compiled Runcible code and destroyed it, provably. When it was finished, Hackworth released the vacuum and lifted the red diamond dome. The finished book stood upright atop the system that had extruded it, which was turned into a junk heap as soon as it was touched by the air. Hackworth picked up the book in his right hand and the extruder in his left and tossed the latter into a junk bin. He locked the book in a desk drawer, picked up his top hat, gloves, and walking stick, stepped into his walker, and set off for the causeway. Towards Shanghai. Nell and Harve's general living situation. The leased territories. Tequila. China was right across the water, and you could see it if you went down to the beach. The city there, the one with skyscrapers, was called Pudong, and beyond that was Shanghai. Harve went there with his friends sometimes. He said it was bigger than you could imagine, old and dirty and full of strange people and sights. They lived in the LT, which, according to Harve, was short for Leased Territories in letters. Nell already knew the mediaglyphics for it. Harve had also taught her the sign for Enchantment, which was the name of the territory where they lived. It was a princess sprinkling golden specks from a stick onto some gray houses, which turned yellow and bright when the specks touched them. Nell thought that the specks were mites, but Harve insisted that mites were too small to be seen, that the stick was a magic wand, and the specks were fairy dust. In any case, Harve made her remember that mediaglyph, so that if she ever got lost, she could find her way home. "But it's better if you just call me," Harve said, "and I'll come and find you." "Why?" "Because there's bad people out there, and you shouldn't walk through the LT alone, ever." "What bad people?" Harve looked troubled, heaved multiple sighs, fidgeted. "You know that raptive I was in the other day, where there were pirates and they tied up the kids and were going to make them walk the plank?"
"Yeah."
"There are pirates in the LT, too."
"Where?"
"Don't bother looking. You can't see them. They don't look like pirates with the big hats and swords and all. They just look like normal people, but they're pirates on the inside, and they like to grab kids and tie them up."
"And make them walk the plank?"
"Something like that."
"Call the police."
"I don't think the police would help." "Maybe they would." Police were Chinese. They came across the causeway from Shanghai. Nell saw them up close once when they came into the house to arrest Mom's boyfriend, Raj. Raj wasn't home, just Nell and Harve were, and so Harve let them in and let them sit in the living room and fetch tea for them. Harve spoke some words of Shanghainese to them, and they grinned and ruffled his hair. He told Nell to stay in their bedroom and not come out, but Nell came out anyway and peeked. There were three policemen, two in uniforms and one in a suit, and they sat smoking cigarettes and watching something on the Mediatron until Raj came back. Then they had an argument with him and took him out, shouting the whole way. After that, Raj didn't come around anymore, and Tequila started going out with Mark. Unlike Raj, Mark had a job.
He worked in the New Atlantis clave, cleaning windows of the Vicky's homes. He would come home late in the afternoon, all tired and dirty, and take a long shower in their bathroom. Sometimes he would have Nell come into the bathroom with him and help scrub his back, because he couldn't quite reach one spot in the middle. Sometimes he would look at Nell's hair and tell her that she needed a bath, and then she would take off her clothes and climb into the shower with him, and he would help wash her. One day, she asked Harv whether Mark ever gave him a shower. Harv got upset and asked her a lot of questions. Later, Harv told Tequila about it, but Tequila had an argument with him and sent him to his room with one side of his face red and puffy. Then Tequila talked to Mark. They argued in the living room, the thumps booming through the wall as Harv and Nell huddled together in Harv's bed. Harv and Nell both pretended to go to sleep that night, but Nell heard Harv getting up and sneaking out of the house. She didn't see him for the rest of the night. In the morning, Mark got up and went to work, and then Tequila got up and put a lot of makeup all over her face and went to work. Nell was alone the whole day, wondering if Mark was going to make her take a shower that evening. She knew from the way Harv had reacted that the showers were a bad thing, and in a way it felt good to know this, because it explained why it felt wrong. She did not know how to stop Mark from making her take the shower this evening. She told Dinosaur, Duck, Peter, and Purple about it. These four creatures were the only animals that had survived a great massacre perpetrated during the previous year by Mac, one of Mom's boyfriends, who, in a fit of rage, had gathered up all of the dolls and stuffed animals in Nell's room and stuffed them into the knacking hatch. When Harv had opened it up a few hours later, he had found all of the toys vanished except for these four. He had explained that the Deke bin would only work on things that had come from the MC originally, and that anything that had been made by hand, a troublesome concept to explain, was rejected. Dinosaur, Duck, Peter, and Purple were old, ragged things that had been made by hand. When Nell told them her story, Dinosaur was brave and said that she should fight Mark. Duck had some ideas, but they were silly ideas because Duck was just a little kid. Peter thought she should run away. Purple thought she should use magic and sprinkle Mark with fairy dust. Some of it would be like the mites that, according to Harv, the Vickies used to protect themselves from bad people. In the kitchen was some food that Tequila had brought home last night, including chopsticks with little mediatrons built into their handles so that the mediaglyphics ran up and down them while you ate. Nell knew that there must be mites in there to make those mediaglyphics, and so she took one of the chopsticks as her magic wand. She also had a silvery plastic balloon that Harv had made her in the MC. All the air had gone out of it. She reckoned it would make a nice shield, like she had once seen on the arm of a knight in one of Harv's ractives. She sat in the corner of the room on her mattress with Dinosaur and Purple in front of her, and Duck and Peter behind her, and waited, clutching her magic wand and her shield. But Mark didn't come home. Tequila came home and wondered where Mark was, but didn't seem to mind that he wasn't there. Finally, Harv came back, late that night, after Nell had gone to bed, and hid something under his mattress. The next day, Nell looked. It was a pair of heavy sticks, each about a foot long, joined in the middle by a short chain, and the whole thing was smeared with reddish-brown stuff that had gone sticky and crusty. The next time Nell saw Harv, he told her that Mark was never coming back, that he was one of the pirates he'd warned her about, and that if anyone else ever tried to do such things to her, she should run away and scream and tell Harv and his friends right away. Nell was astonished. She had not understood just how tricky pirates were until this moment.